The Fan on Demand. Untouchable. Seriously, we dare you to try and touch him. Bob McCowan at Primetime Sports. Now. On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hour, and it's Tuesday, the 16th of September. I was going to say February. Why is February on my brain?
I don't know.
We're just talking about December.
Pitchers and catchers report. No, wait. That's not.
They do.
It's not February.
I don't know. It's September, by the way. I don't think anybody. Oh, I know what it was. I was reading the Almanac.
Really?
The Farmer's Almanac.
And?
It was going to be cold. But apparently in southern Ontario, it's not going to be not as much snow. Rest of Canada, one snowstorm after another.
Okay,
you're buried in snow.
I will plan my life accordingly.
So I don't think you want to be going on the road to too many Hockey Night in Canada events. Well, Rogers Hockey Night in Canada.
Well, if you notice, they're all in
hometown
very
hockey.
They're
places.
All in a cold places.
No, you're never going to get there, and you're never going to get out.
I'm going to a couple.
A decade ago today.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday. Whatever. The collective bargaining agreement with the NHL and the PA expired, and a lockout shut down the NHL business for what turned out to be an entire season.
Only league ever to do that.
And we thought it noteworthy enough on this 10th anniversary to at least address this. And our next guest certainly had a role in that. I'm not suggesting he was implicit in doing anything.
He was a stakeholder.
But he went through it. Here's the owner of the Ottawa Senators. Here's Eugene Melnyk. Mr. Melnyk, how was your summer?
Busy, 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 Bob. It was it was actually nonstop. You know, I didn't have a lot of time to rest, and going from one place to another, and it was great, though. It's fun. I'm totally exhausted, but that's what summers are for.
Well, no, but summer's supposed to wind down during the summer, Melnyk. What's the matter with you?
I understand that, but sometimes the gods don't line up in the right way, and I end up working twice as hard as I do during hockey season, which isn't all bad.
No, I guess not. I mean, I'll leave it to you. If you're okay with it, we're okay with it. So let's go back a decade. What's your overriding memory of that year of no hockey? I mean, there must have been a million things go through your mind, but what's the one thing that jumps out at you in terms of looking back?
The longest winter ever in my life.
It was, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for all of us. I mean, I think, it's hockey's part of our DNA, and it's what we do. And, to have, a very, very, very long winter. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
That's what I remember. It was like an absolute, just a very, very, very long winter. And, we got through it. And, the league is better for it. And it's 10 years ago now. And I think it's never been the league has never been healthier than it is now. Players are, more compensated than they ever were. The on-ice product is getting better and better every year. I think that we're now, in a position where everybody's, pleased with where they are, including myself.
On the day that the players were locked out, Gene, how did you think it was going to play out?
It was tough because at the end of the day, we had I remember it being a very, very tough negotiations. And, you know, nobody wanted it. I know that. The players didn't want it. We didn't want it. But it was just, you know, it happened. And it happened so quick that, you know, everybody was, I guess, in disbelief. I remember being asked about it, and I said, this is the darkest day in hockey ever. And it was. And I think now, you know, it's much better than it ever was before. And that's the good part. So this is where we are today, and we're looking forward to, you know, the thing continuing to grow and business to grow, and everybody more just now becoming huge interest from fans that were never fans before, a whole new generation coming up, and it's wonderful.
But, you know, lockouts have become a pretty familiar tactic, you know, from management side. We don't have strikes anymore because of the way the timing works. No, the players aren't going to strike at the beginning of a season, but we have had other lockouts, and, you know, they seem premeditated, to be honest. They seem tactical. Are you saying that, you know, when you guys decided to lock out, you weren't anticipating having to lock the players out, or you didn't think that a lockout was kind of going to be a good way to bring them around?
No, absolutely not. It was... I think it was like it was, you know, kind of boxed in, and you know, I do recall a few things, and you know, then I want to move on, but because you guys got limited time, but I do remember one thing, and that's to myself. I thought, you know, there's 700 guys out there. Do they really know what's going on? And do they really understand the issues? And are they getting it? And I remember that part. I really do. And I remember saying, I think publicly, I said, you know, let them go and vote. We'll put them all in a big arena and let them go up and vote and decide what they want to do. And that's kind of my vivid memories of that. And but no, it was definitely not like, you know, a tactic or anything like that. It just like it just happened. And it was, I think, almost spontaneous. So at the end, it's a you know, a memory that you'll never forget as long as you live, and you never want it to repeat itself. So you continue making everybody happy and continue. And the only way to do that is, you know, create a bigger fan base, make sure the players are, you know, competitive on ice. The on-ice product continues to get better and better, which I think it is. I just heard before this, me coming on, I heard that little snippet from Bill Daly about the diving and all that kind of stuff. It's just another thing that we're doing to, and it's on me, it's the league that's doing it, to make it a better product, and I think it's great.
With Eugene Melnyk, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, those of us who covered it and were involved in it from at least from the outside looking in, my you know, from my perspective, my recollection is that there were significant moments during that time period where it appeared as if something might actually happen. I don't remember how optimistic anybody really was about it, but this wasn't a flatline year. This was a year with ups and downs and ebbs and flows and maybes and maybe nots. Was there ever a moment, do you recall a moment when you thought, all right, we're going to get this thing done now, finally?
Kind of. Again, it's 10 years ago, so it's...
I know.
And it's not one of the most pleasant memories, so you kind of try to park it somewhere in a dark space where you don't have to go back to and think about it. So I don't really remember any one thing that, you know, jumps out at you other than the fact of what I said earlier. But, you know, again, it's like 10 years ago. Like, I've parked it. It's gone. You know, it's we're way too, everybody's, I think, way too smart now to realize, you know, what happens in these situations. And, you know, I don't think, I can't see it ever happening again.
The one that jumped
for a long time.
The one that jumps out at me, and I don't know whether you were involved in it or have a recollection of it, but Bob Goodenough was the head of the NHL Players Association, and there was a last ditch attempt to kind of resolve the thing. And I remember Trevor Linden got involved, and there was a meeting in, I believe, in New York City, where Mario Lemieux and Wayne Gretzky were invited to the meeting, and there was a sense that something was going to come from the Players Association, and it never came.
Remember that one? Yeah. Now it's coming back. Yes.
You remember that? There was like a five-hour meeting, and I gather the owners were on one side of the table saying, you know, we're led to believe that you're going to put an offer on the table. But it was sort of, they circumvented Goodenough, or tried to. He found out about it the night before, put the kibosh on it, and everybody kind of just sat there and looked at each other, and nobody wanted to say what we all thought was going to get said, which was there was a deal on the table, and I think the number that they came back with was going to be $45 million cap, and the league was probably going to take it at 45.
I remember where I was.
Remember that?
40. Yeah. I remember that.
And what's interesting in retrospect, Gene, is that, you know, the league was prepared to take 45 at that point if the Players Association had only put it on the table. And if you go back and look at it, the cap wound up at 39.
I know.
They just wouldn't open their mouths and do it.
Go figure. Yeah, I know. It's, like I said, I remember it just being a total, you know. But look, everybody got through it. You know, that's the bottom line. And I think Gary did a great job. And I know a lot of you guys think I just say that. I think he did a spectacular job. I couldn't do what he did, and to this day I can't do what he does. And it was tough because he was being criticized left and right as the evil one and all that. And he was putting. I told him. I said, I don't know how you and your wife, you know, sleep at night, but you know, whatever we pay you, isn't enough. But you know, he did a great job. It got done. Everybody. I think is happy now and making a ton of money as far as the players are concerned. And everybody is it's a better game now. So it's, you can't complain.
It was tough for you too, Eugene, because
it was my first year.
You had 1 year, right?
I know.
You just took over the club almost a year to the date before. So you had 1 year of running the Ottawa Senators and all of a sudden your league is shut down.
Your factory just got shut down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, welcome to the NHL, huh?
Yeah. It's kind of ironic, but it's healthier now, and the game is healthier, and it is what it is. But that was kind of a wake up call.
How long did it take you to make up the money lost during that season?
I don't even talk about finance anymore because every time I open my mouth about finance on your show, I get destroyed.
Well, that's no reason not to do it, though.
Not by us.
But it's there's a cost benefit.
Twins or something. I don't know.
Well, let's send that guy over to the phone then because he's great. we like him.
Yeah, but I don't know. The math is the math, and we've got a tough job to make hockey work in Ottawa, but we're trying to make it work. We are a very regional market. The biggest employer in the city can't buy tickets, nor can they be given tickets. The number two biggest employer is the city, and they can't buy tickets or give tickets. And we're number 29 out of 30 of corporate opportunities, and it's not easy. And we have a fan base that is price sensitive, and so we came up with a plan, and I think our plan's working, and that is you don't have to keep throwing crazy money to put together a team. Put all of your money into good scouting, good development, bring these kids up, and make your superstars as opposed to, you know, trying to buy them, and I think it's working.
Let's talk a little bit about your hockey team in the couple minutes we have left. 2 years ago.
How about my Ukraine thing?
Oh, you want to talk about that?
It was fantastic. Wayne Gretzky came to this event. It's a charitable event for the Ukraine. I'm a big supporter of the Ukraine. And, he did this huge charitable event. Like, it wasn't supposed to be, it was like 1,200 people, and I called him on a Sunday. I mean, talk about, a salt-of-the-earth guy and his wife, Janet. And I called him on a Sunday, and I said, do you mind coming to dinner with me? And he thought I was inviting him to dinner. Right, a Ukrainian dinner.
Oh.
And I said, well, there's only going to be like 1,200 of your best friends coming to this thing. And he stood up and he spoke because he has Ukrainian roots.
Yeah.
It was a massive success. Huge, huge. And Harper spoke at it, the prime minister.
Right.
And it was wonderful. He said some really great things. And, the guy, just people couldn't stop clapping for him. I mean, if you take a look at his records, you know, people don't realize how huge this guy was until I did my research. I mean, this guy got, like, in 1 year, 215 points.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of that?
No, it's like stupid stuff. And we do tend to forget. You're right. We do tend to forget.
Like 4 seasons, he got over 200 points.
I know.
He took Ovechkin, and Crosby's total points last year was 183.
There you go.
And in 1 year, do you know, as a kid, as a peewee, he always played with older kids. The guy scored 385 goals as a peewee.
Yeah.
And you look at this guy, and I actually asked him, I said, you know, Wayne, how do you think you'd do against these gorillas these days? He says, they wouldn't stand a chance. By the time they looked around, I'd be already past him and putting the puck in. So he's confident that he'd do well in today's NHL. But this guy really is one of the greatest ambassadors of our game, and I only wish him the best and Janet the best as well. So I just wanted to say that little plug on Wayne and our cause, which is United for Ukraine. And, yeah, it was just really good. Got to get you out there. Say a few
words. Anytime you need it, all you got to do is pick up the phone. We'd be happy to help. I know that. I can assure you that. You know,
as far as the hockey team is concerned, you know, the season's starting, and we're all excited. We got I just got the numbers. We got like 5 goalies, 19 defensemen, 33 forwards coming to camp. It's going to be a lot of testosterone around Ottawa.
Always.
And, yeah, and a lot of young kids that are going to be fighting for spots. And, you know, I think our system is working. And if everybody just plays up to their potential, we, you know, as Brian Murray said, you know, we're a playoff team. So all we need is everybody to play up. And, you know, we could be right there. It's a great group. It's a really great group, and they're very hungry. So that's all good.
2 years ago, you thought you had a rebuilding program that you were kind of at the early stages of, and your team turned out to be a lot better than almost anybody thought, including you by your own acknowledgement on this program on a couple of occasions. How was it to watch the team at least temporarily take a step backwards last year instead of a step forward?
That was hard. I think it was very, very hard because nobody expected it. We expected it to be, I think everybody did. And, you know, everybody's had a long, long summer to try to figure out, you know, what in God's name happened. And I think, you know, everybody took a step back, our defense and our, just the shots on there. And then, it just everything that could go wrong went wrong, and I think everybody's learned from it. Nobody wants to repeat that, and that's what I mean by hungry. You know, I talked to enough coaches around, and they said, you know, these guys really want to be, you know, you want them coming in pissed off into the season.
Right.
You want them pissed off because it's not a pleasant feeling. So they're going to go. I think we'll get everything we want out of them. And barring, you know, unforeseen injuries, we are deep everywhere. We got too many players that, you know, we will be able to trade if we need to. Not that we want to, but if we have to. We just got too many great talents. And I'm prepared to spend, you know, a lot more money if we're competitive. And if that makes the difference going deep into the playoffs, it makes it all worthwhile. So I'm there for it. I'm ready to spend the money. It's just we need to spend it smart. That's all.
I know that ticket sales are always an issue in Ottawa, at least, you know, getting to sellouts. In relative terms, where do you sit right now, and are you happy with where you sit in terms of ticket sales?
I think we're getting there. We, you know, I think all of the NHL... you know, the trend is moving towards, and you can go through a lot of the teams' arenas. We're doing a huge refurbishment, like $10 million or whatever it is, to shrink the arena and turn it into like a lot of clubs and, you know, stuff that people can actually entertain themselves, because you don't need, what's the point of having 20,000 seats if, you know, you only fill 19? You might as well have 17, 18, like, you know, Winnipeg, and, you know, sell out every night.
Yeah,
so
if that.
We're moving that way, and we are going to spend the next year refurbishing a lot of the like great sections and shrink it a little bit, but that will create all sorts of, you know, demand, and I think we'll do, I think it, we're, but look, if you've got a winning team, and I think a lot of cities are like that, they rally behind it,
yeah,
and you're sold out all the time. If you don't, they just sit there and say, you know what, I'll stay at home because I got to. It's easier for me to take the pain at home. So,
yeah. You're actually going to pull your capacity down, though, because you have a big rink there to start with. So you're going to.
We got the second biggest rink, yeah, in Canada. It's huge. It was way overbuilt. We got way too many suites. And we recognize that. I wasn't involved in that thing because that was 20 plus years ago. But mm-hmm. now we're spending the money to build these. And again, they've done it in Tampa very successfully. They're doing it in other cities, and we've seen them do it where they have these kind of like lounge
areas. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's become very, very popular. So you're still going to get people come, like you're going to have people, but it's now become an entertainment type of place to go to, and you know, all of that helps. So it's going to be, you know, the sight lines. We still, I think, have the best sight lines in any arena in the league. We have our boxes are the lowest of anyone in the league, meaning like we're 23 rows up, and. It just needs some tweaking to the configuration. That's all, and we've pretty much fixed the traffic problems that they had out there. Yeah, we're looking for. It's going to be fine. I mean, we're going to be okay, but you can always do better, and that's what we're going to try to do.
Well, we'll come and see you during the season, and
I hope you do.
If you need any help, all you got to do is pick up the phone. You know that, all right?
United for Ukraine. Thanks for. I really appreciate you saying that.
Happy to help.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Melnyk. We'll see you soon. Eugene Melnyk, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, who maybe for the first time in all his appearances on this program, didn't get himself in trouble. I don't think.
Darn. Bring back the evil twin.
Well, we'll give him one. Season hasn't started.
I don't know, Bob. I don't know.
And we're reflecting on something 10 years ago.
Yeah, but anyway.
Something will come up.
Bring back the evil twin.
We'll call Melnyk. Everything will go back to normal.
Got to get him back to his winter haunt down in the Caribbean there. Because the evil twin hangs out there a fair bit, I believe.
Well, when you call him at the bar.
Yes.
The chances of getting something a little spicier increase significantly.
Mm-hmm.
Sounded like he just got out of a meeting or something.
Yeah. No, he sounded very serious.
Well, I thought he was in good spirits.
Yeah, I know he's happy, but just, yeah.
It has been... a most interesting last couple of weeks and actually last couple of months in the sports world. As more than at any time I can recall, our attention has been drawn away from what has happened on the field of play and onto things that involve athletes, but not their performance on the field of play. Everything from... Tony Stewart striking and killing Kevin Ward Jr. and questions about whether that was an avoidable accident, to Ray Rice, to an endless stream of things. And who better to discuss all of these, although not necessarily in one lump sum, than our legal analyst, Rob Becker, who's with us. Hello, Mr. Becker. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. I started with Tony Stewart only because there's more recent news. A grand jury will decide whether Stewart will be charged in the August death of Kevin Ward. I think everybody has seen the video. I'm not suggesting we show it again. I don't think that's necessary, but I think everybody has seen that video. Do you have an opinion on whether you think this thing will wind up going into a courtroom?
Yes, I think it will, particularly because of today's news. You know, when a DA brings evidence in front of a grand jury, that's usually because he wants to get an indictment. And particularly in New York State, it's so easy to get grand juries to indict if you're a DA. I may have mentioned many years ago that the chief judge of New York State said that a DA in New York can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. I mean, it's just not that difficult. So to me, it's very likely that he's going to be indicted. And to me, the question is, for what crime will he be indicted?
Mm-hmm.
And basically what we're saying is, I mean, there's no doubt that his car struck Kevin Ward and Kevin Ward died as a result of it. The issue is what was Tony Stewart's mental state, and that will determine, you know, the level of crime that he'd be indicted for. And that really there's four possibilities, but you know, the least bad would be criminally negligent homicide, which would mean, you know, he was negligent, he didn't realize there were risks, but he made a mistake and he hurt him. And I personally don't think that's what it's going to be because, you know, as you probably discussed, Tony Stewart has been driving these cars all his life. you know, they have a very special way of acting, but he knows how to control them. So it's hard for me to think that you know, he was negligent and didn't know what he was doing. And then at the other end of the spectrum, which again I don't think is going to happen, would be second degree murder, where he intended to kill Kevin Ward and he did so. And again, I don't think anyone believes that Tony Stewart intended to kill Kevin Ward. Why would he? So where I come down, what I think he's going to be indicted for is in New York State, it's second-degree manslaughter, which means you were reckless, which means you knew there was a risk of something, and you took that risk anyway, and it happened. And he knew that if you hit the accelerator while you're going around the curve, as he did, that there was a good chance the back of the car would swing out to the right, which meant it could hit Kevin Ward. So I think that's what they're going to indict him for, and if that's what they indict him for, he could get 1 to 15 years.
But Kevin Ward got out of a race car in the middle of a race and stood there and waved his arms at people.
Right.
So
it doesn't make any difference. I mean, as long as he sees him there and he takes the risk anyway, he still committed the crime. In other words, look at it this way, guys. You're driving your car, and you see it's a green light, and you see a guy go walk out into the crosswalk when you know he shouldn't be doing it because he's not supposed to be crossing. Can you then still intentionally hit him or recklessly hitting? No, you can't, because you see where he is, and you could do something about it, and you're not allowed to just hit the guy or be reckless about it just because he's doing something that in some sense he's not supposed to be doing. So to me, the fact that he got out of the car and did something dumb is not a defense.
Well, except that someone jaywalking on a, you know, as a pedestrian on a street in a city is something one could anticipate. You know, that does happen, right? Guy standing in the middle of racetracks as cars are going around at an incredible rate of speed.
That happens too, Stephen.
Well, not very often. You know, you got to crash. You know, until they bring the safety guys out and they, you know, wave the yellow flag, you're supposed to sit in your car.
No, I know. But
unless you're on fire, you know.
It happens. Not only do we know it happens, but more to the point, it appears, although maybe this isn't true, but it appears that he saw him. I mean, even if it was unbelievably unusual, if he saw him and had time to decide not to hit the accelerator, and yet he still hit the accelerator, which he knew would create this risk, then he's committed the crime. It's not really relevant how often that happens or how startled he may have been, as long as he had time to do something about it or to not do the thing that he did.
Boy, I don't know. They're gonna have to you have to read his mind for that, though, aren't you?
Well, that's difficult, but what you have to do is get all the circumstantial evidence. You have to be able to try, and apparently they have this enhanced video recreation that the state of New York did for the DA there. And I assume that what they've tried to do is figure out exactly what Tony Stewart could see and when, and what when he hit the gas pedal, and what those cars normally do when you hit the gas pedal. And I think they're trying to recreate everything that he could see and what he did, and then say, well, here's an experienced car driver, and he did this, and under those circumstances, would you conclude that he knew there was a risk and he took it? And I mean, I'm not saying this is an easy case to win, but I don't think it's an impossible case to win either.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, I mean, there's a million questions, and I mean, we're obviously going to have an opportunity to talk about this a bit more, because as you suggest, it is very likely the grand jury will, in the state of New York, will indict him.
Indict him for something.
For something. Yeah. And we're going to wind up going to court in all likelihood.
Hey, Rob, can I ask one? To one of the other stories, we've got a bunch of stuff to cover here. But, you know, the Adrian Peterson obviously is one of the stories that's the things Bob was talking about. Legally, where is the line drawn between acceptable corporal punishment of a child by a parent and child abuse?
Well, first of all, on the face of the statute in Texas, which I did look at last week, it's not a statute about discipline. It's a statute about physical injury to a child. And all it really relates to is whether or not you caused physical injury to a child and what your – and again, the same issues of what your mindset was, whether it's reckless or intentional. And under the statute, there is no difference whether it's your child or somebody else's child. It's not about that. It's just about whether you harmed him. Now, that's what the law is on its face. Now, I did hear the DA down there say that, yes, you know, you have a right to discipline your child, but it has to be reasonable. And that he said that the grand jury in Texas did not consider that to be reasonable discipline of your child. And, you know, that may be an arguable point about what's reasonable, except that I don't think that once you've seen pictures, once it's clear that he struck him all over his body and raised welts and bruises, I don't think there is much doubt that it's reasonable. And certainly on the face of the law, he caused an injury. And I think that, I think he's lucky, guys, because he, Peterson, we know what he's charged with. He's charged with either negligent or recklessly causing physical injury to a child. In other words, he was not charged with knowingly doing it. And frankly, I think that it wouldn't have been ridiculous to charge him with that, because particularly, see, the difference between, for instance, this crime and the Stewart crime is one act. The Peterson crime is a repeated series of acts over and over. You keep striking your child. You know what you're doing, and you can see the results of the earlier strikings. So he's kind of lucky that all they're charging with him at worst is recklessness. And I think it's a good case. One thing I find disturbing is this: there's some murmurings about, you know, in certain parts of the United States, you know, culturally, that's what you do. It doesn't make any difference. That's not consistent with the law in American mores, or I assume with Canadian mores either. And so I think Peterson's in trouble.
Yesterday we got word of a possible second indictment, a second issue with another child, which presumably came up as a result of the publicity of this one. If, in fact, there's meat on that bone, could the two cases in any way be used against him as one?
You mean in a court of law? Or
yes, in a court of law. Like, if we're talking two different children and two different acts.
Right. Well, there are a couple of things, Bob. First of all, although I very much hesitate to accept the word of Rusty Hardin, who, as you may recall, was Roger Clemens' lawyer and now Peterson's lawyer. But I hesitate. But what he said was that on that other incident, he said that was raised several times in the past and no one would prosecute it and it's a dead issue. So it maybe it'll go nowhere. But if it does go somewhere, it could be relevant in that it's a similar act to some extent, or maybe it isn't.
We believe it is.
It's similar. Actually, it's similar in that it involves striking a child. On the other hand, all I've seen is a description that he hit a child in the head. And, you know, it might have been an accident. I don't know. But if it's similar enough to the new incident with the switch, then it would be evidence that he tends to do things like this. And it could be relevant.
Could it be raised if – all right, so these cases – if we proceed with this, if there's a second indictment, these cases would not be heard simultaneously. They'd be heard separately because it's two different children, two different mothers,
right.
We think.
It absolutely should be. In fact, I don't even know if it's in the same jurisdiction.
Right, it may not even be.
It's really two unrelated crimes.
All right, so let me give you a what-if here. You are the prosecuting attorney in the first case to go in front of a judge. Are you allowed to allude to the second indictment?
I think you have to be able to have evidence that the event happened, not merely that he was indicted. You would have to have some evidence that showed that the other event took place. And the fact that he was indicted, that's not enough to show it took place. But if you could, you know, if you could
what's
have
enough?
Testify.
What would be enough?
I would say if someone came in and testified to the other event, or there was some sort of document that could get through the various evidentiary objections, a document that showed that it took place. If you could do that, then you could bring it in. I don't think you need a conviction. You just need actual evidence that it took place.
And how would that impact on the first case? I mean, it's what does it demonstrate, and how might it sway either a judge or a jury? Whoever is adjudicating the case.
It demonstrates a pattern of behavior. You can show past acts to show a pattern of similar behavior. And that's why if it was a very different sort of striking, like say, I don't know, if you punched a kid by accident or just punched him once, you might argue that that's a completely different thing
from
hitting someone with a switch.
Right. So it'd have to be pertinent to that case in some way, shape, or form. I gotcha.
Like, it would be terrible for Peterson if you could demonstrate that he had done these, hit another kid with a switch and gave him bruises and open welts.
Quickly, not surprisingly, Ray Rice is considering a lawsuit against the National Football League, citing double jeopardy, being punished twice for the same act. Is that reasonable?
No, there's a lot of problems. He does have some things that he can do, but that is not one of them. Number one, double jeopardy under the United States Constitution is something that applies to a state or federal government, not to the National Football League, so it's completely irrelevant. Secondly, you could argue it isn't double jeopardy, it's just an increased punishment. So that's not what he should be doing. And plus, although he can appeal the suspension, this suspension will probably just go right back to Goodell, and I doubt Goodell is going to reverse himself. What he can do is say you had no basis for increasing it because you already knew I punched out my girlfriend and knocked her unconscious, so you had no basis for changing from two games. Secondly, he can say you certainly don't have any basis for going over six games because you just announced a new policy that said six games for a first domestic violence violation, which is exactly what Rice did. So that's probably his best argument, is you can't give me more than six. But remember, the thing that he really can be concentrating on, I think, is the fact that the Ravens cut him. Because the CBA says that once the commissioner suspends you for disciplinary action, a team can't also discipline you for the same thing. So he should argue, when they cut me, they were doing the same thing the commissioner did, and they're not allowed to do that. Even if they pay me, they're not allowed to do that. So I think he can get – I think he's in a position to say once the suspension is over, the Ravens have to take him back.
That's interesting. I also would think.
Well, at least they have to pay him.
I would think, Rob, also that the league
would even take him back. It goes beyond that, Bob.
Yeah,
they would have to pay him and put him on the team and play him.
But they don't have to pay him under suspension, right? They wouldn't.
Suspension, they're safe. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know the other thing, you know, I would think the National Football League does not, you know, Ray Rice and his people claim that in the hearing he had before Roger Goodell, after which led to the first suspension, that Ray Rice said this is what happened in the elevator accurately. Right. You know, and the NFL is reacting as though they were told something different. And then they saw the second tape and they said, oh, my, that's not what we thought happened. That's not what we were told. I would think that's territory the NFL doesn't necessarily want to get into.
Well, I mean, I don't know. In the end, I don't really care what he told them, because here's the bottom line is it was known in February that he knocked his girlfriend out with one punch. That was on the police complaint was actually on the Internet for people to read. So what's the difference between knocking your girlfriend out with one punch and having a video of it? It's the same act.
Ask Roger Goodell. Roger Goodell thinks there's a difference. Because he changed the suspension.
Is he really prepared to say that what makes a difference is that whether or not people see it? It's the same act. I mean, you may be right that that's how Goodell thinks, that what he cares about is what people see. But to me, I don't think that's a valid ground.
I'm with you.
Change the amount.
No, we're both making Ray Rice's case here, though, aren't we?
Well, sure. I mean,
yeah.
I think he has, but the problem is that case, the case that you can't give me more than two games, even though you and I like that argument, since the appeal is to Goodell, it doesn't matter. Goodell can do whatever he wants to do under the CBA. He has a final decision. So what I'm saying is he has the freedom to make an irrational judgment.
Last point, real quick. I need about a 60-second response to this. The Toronto Blue Jays and Creighton University are in a dust-up, it would appear, over the logos of those two organizations. Creighton University is a 136-year-old Jesuit university in Nebraska that has been known as the Creighton Blue Jays for, well, a lot longer than the Toronto Blue Jays.
Right.
That isn't really an issue. But Creighton recently altered the look of their mascot, which the Toronto Blue Jays think is a little too close to theirs, which they say could cause confusion. They would like Creighton to change it again, cease, desist, do something. Is there a case here? Who's the favorite in this one?
I'd say Toronto. First of all, to be clear, Toronto's only saying that Creighton should not be allowed to register their mark so far. As far as we know, they haven't told Creighton that they have to stop using the mark. But the reason I think it's a decent case is they're saying that the bird is shown from the side with basically the same general pattern of blue and the same kind of solid shapes. And if you look at them, they are similar. And to me, the key point is that bird is used together with the word Blue Jay. So if you see the Toronto Blue Jays word and their logo, and then you see Creighton Blue Jays word with their logo, I think there actually is a realistic possibility that you could be confused and think that the one is being done, that Creighton's team is somehow sponsored by or associated with Toronto. And what's one weird part of this is that several years ago, Creighton, and we don't know how this happened, used to use a logo that was identical to Toronto's. And that might have been under a contract. I have no idea. But it certainly shows that they were thinking pretty carefully about Toronto, and I think that could work against them. So overall, the favorite is Toronto in my mind.
It's always good to have you with us. Thank you, Mr. Becker. Talk to you soon.
Okay, see you later.
Rob Becker, our legal analyst from New York. We'll take the break and come back with some final thoughts. This is Primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.
Prices like no other, from a club like no other, the Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, the Fan.
Looky, here comes Cookie. You have 4 minutes.
Okay, this way I get to ask you a question.
What do you want to know?
Did you watch the ball game last night? His first question. Yes, I did, Steve.
I'm trying to think of what I did last night. Did I watch the ball game last night?
What did you think of Marcus Stroman being in
I did.
Being in a guy, too.
Well, I was one of those in-and-out nights.
Okay. But, you know, there's a play at home plate. Reyes got... But it's very hockey-ish, and I'm, you know, throwing baseballs at people...
It's not the first time you've ever seen it.
No, but do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't like it. I don't like it particularly because I have a great question. I watched the play over and over again with Reyes.
Yep.
I actually saw it live, and then I watched the replays and stuff. I've seen far worse stuff. If he stepped on his hand, I think it was by accident. Now, did he try and block the plate by turning his foot and his leg? Sure he did.
Yeah.
And we see that almost every play. You know, it's one of those, I'm not going to block the plate, but I'm going to block the plate. Now, they don't get down in a crouch. They don't do a body slam. They don't stand there waiting for the guy. They try and give him a path, but at the last minute, they want to shut that path off.
Correct.
Right? So that's really what happened. I don't think the catcher did anything untoward. You slide headfirst into home plate. And I understand why Reyes doesn't want to slide feet first anymore since he ripped himself open in second base last year.
Season last year, essentially.
Yeah, so I get that, but that's a very dangerous play. He didn't wind up getting seriously hurt. I think Reyes made more of it than needed to be made. But when that happened, there is this 23-year-old or whatever he is, Marcus Stroman, sitting on the bench, and says, well, he didn't throw at my guy, but he did something. I got to retaliate. I don't think it was necessary. But usually what we see in these situations, you would acknowledge, is one pitcher throws at the other guy, accidental or otherwise, because he hit a home run off him the last time.
Yep.
And then the other pitcher feels like he's got to do the same thing.
Well, you feel like your teammates expect you to stick up for it.
And that still happens in the game today. I don't know. I don't particularly like it. I don't think it serves any real purpose. All that happens is if somebody gets thrown out of the game, there's no real lasting message.
Well, and, you know, you got a guy, Giancarlo Stanton, getting hit in the face the other day.
Yeah.
You know, it's you can kill someone with a baseball.
Wow, was that scary, too.
And, I know you can hit a guy in a place where it's not going to hurt him as much, or you can try to, or you have enough control over the baseball, you can throw it behind his head like Stroman did last night. But
the truth is it was high and behind him.
Yeah, but...
Which can be dangerous, too, because if it's not that
that's
high...
That's the whole point.
Guy's tendency is to back into the pitch.
And you still have this missile.
It's arguably more dangerous to throw it behind a guy's head than close to his head.
You know, if Zahn was here, by the way, congrats, Greg. He's a dad now.
Yes, he is.
Who is as old school as they come. I would be interested to hear what Zahn's version of it is. I wonder if he would have said, that's what you got
to
do.
I think he'd go right to the code, wouldn't he? That's what you got to do. But for me, I think it was different. I don't think Reyes had an argument, and I think it's different from the other pitcher throws at my guy. I got to throw at that guy. But then again, it's all kind of stupid. Maybe they ought to have more punishment than a warning or you get tossed from the game. Maybe a big-ass fine, and the game would get rid of that kind of stuff. Our thanks to Rob Becker and Eugene Melnick for joining us on the program. I'm going home to read the Almanac. I will report tomorrow on how your weather will be all of next year. Good night from Toronto.